learn about these sickening atrocities, the worse it gets. Hamas deliberately targeted civilians and massacred them just because they are Jews. Hamas has again killed innocent Americans and civilians from many other countries, and Hamas has abducted entirely innocent civilians.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin earlier today, the images coming out of Israel and the Gaza Strip are bloody and chaotic. Bodies lay covered, buildings destroyed, tears, anger. You might be experiencing this on TV or cable news or reading reputable news sites like the New York Times, the Washington Post, or like hundreds of millions of people around the world on social media. Content about the conflict has been viewed billions of times on TikTok, eyewitness accounts, opinions, but also videos from other conflicts and video game footage misrepresented as images from this conflict. On X, formerly known as Twitter, fake posts and misinformation remain unmoderated. So there was a fuzzy video of soccer player Cristiano Ronaldo waving a Palestinian flag. That was false. Even Hamas terrorists shared videos of their raids on X and the social media platform Telegram, hoping these less moderated platforms would allow the bloody footage to spread more freely. While Israel's official TikTok channel posted videos of families and children purportedly pleading with terrorists for their lives. There's another fog of war, and it is on your phone. Ben Smith, editor-in-chief for Semaphore, is with me now to discuss this conflict, how it's being covered on social media and elsewhere. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think most of us would, especially in the media, automatically go to X, formerly Twitter, for what was happening as it was happening, for breaking news. Now, that's a lot more difficult a prospect because of the moderation problem. What is your experience with X?
Well, you know, when people talk about content moderation on these platforms, particularly on Twitter, X, whatever we're calling it now, this all really began with horrible terrorist atrocities back, you know, about 10 years ago when ISIS started using Twitter in particular to publicize its just most gruesome beheadings, attacks, murders. And these things went incredibly viral on Twitter. And many, many people suddenly were looking at these horrific images on their screens. And the U.S. government and various other sources said to Twitter, you got to stop distributing terrorist propaganda. Mm-hmm. And they did. And that was in some ways the beginning of a path that led them toward a much more politically divisive set of arguments around content moderation, a big backlash against it, and back toward a wide open space where, people are using it to spread terrorist propaganda again. It's sort of full circle.
Yeah. And really just giving blue check marks to anyone who wants to pay for them, you know, they're not necessarily a verified news outlet.
Right. I mean, there were a series of moves that the former management of Twitter made to, you know, to establish authority, to try to choose between what's true and what's false and what speech we approve of and what we don't. And whenever you go down that path, you're going to make some mistakes, among other things, which they did. But they also tried to, using this system of blue check marks, which again was kind of arbitrary and strange, to say these are legitimate sources of information, these aren't. Some people mm-hmm. were on the wrong sides of those lines. Now that's totally gone. You have no idea what's a legitimate source of information. Anyone can pay to have the thing that used to mean legitimate source of information now just mean I get a little extra boost for my content, whatever it is. And Hamas in particular has been seeding these videos on X. And there are other, it's now a much more fragmented universe, by the way. Twitter, X are less central. Telegram is a very important way information gets out of conflict zones, really is effectively totally unmoderated.
So how do you see that? How do you look at that? Because at the one time, on the one hand, free information flowing freely. On the other hand, free information flowing freely, and we don't know what's real and what's not.
I mean, I think that for most consumers, certainly the way we think about it at Semaphore, social media has increasingly become this sort of, you know, post-apocalyptic wasteland where you can go, if you are very skilled in wearing a hazmat suit, digging around for, you know, nuggets of uranium. But for, I think, a lot of consumers, they're looking for a layer on top of it of journalists to in publications and trusted sources, whatever they may be, and different people trust different things, to say, hey, this is real, this isn't real, here's some context.
Well, still, even that is difficult because I'll take, for example, the story of the beheaded children that was circulating yesterday, put out there by a trusted news organization from Israel, and yet it hasn't been verified by other news organizations, and yet it's been repeated over and over and over again. So with a story like that, even seasoned journalists, how are they to know if it's true or not, if they're not actually on the ground and looking at those bodies?
In wartime, in conflict zones, there's a real fog of war. There are always reports that go out, you know, that are false. And I think a lot of, and with that particular story, which I noticed was on the front page of the New York Post today, journalists ought to be really, really careful about making sure that they have firsthand, they have great sources making a claim like that. On the other hand, I think a lot of journalists feel very careful about not being seen as saying like, hey, you know, they did actually kill a lot of children, but not in exactly this way. And to be seen as dismissing the horror of the violence. And I think that's another feature of social media, actually, in some way, that even in just trying to present facts, you're very likely to be seen and treated as a partisan.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems to be true for a lot of younger people who don't trust mainstream media and go to TikTok for their news. I think I saw a statistic that says at least 20% of young people see TikTok as their main source of news. And you have all of these people posting videos that are seen by many people, young people especially, as more authentic because they aren't doing the he said, she said, play it down the middle kind of reporting.
You know, it's not just young people who don't trust most media or who are on TikTok. If you sort of look at the numbers, I actually think that young people who are particularly native to TikTok are much less easily fooled, are much less likely to be tricked by a scene from a video game that's circulating that people say is real. But I actually think in this moment, I mean, right, a big part of the problem is you know, a sense people don't know what's real and what's not and can kind of choose their reality. And I think that's your, and as you see the growing sophistication of deep fakes in situations like this, I actually think the biggest challenge won't so much be that people are being tricked by a false thing as that their overall trust in everything is getting eroded.
Yeah. Right. But it's this idea of authenticity and that people may see mainstream media as quoting academics and experts and people who aren't on the ground as less authentic.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think if you look at the history of American mainstream media, those are reasonable complaints, by the way. Like if you look at American coverage of the Iraq War, which was, you know, horribly misguided and led to one of the great tragedies of the country's history, it would have been better if there had been Iraqis tweeting about what was happening on the ground. And I think right now we're in this moment when journalists and citizens are like trying to synthesize these things and aren't necessarily wanting to go back to a single source that they don't totally trust, whatever it is, but also are incredibly alienated from the chaos of social media. And I think the challenge is to try to find some way between those.
Right. And coincidentally, today, the Washington Post announced, around 250 buyouts, and there may be layoffs later, but they're saying their audience is down 28%, subscriptions down 15%, revenue down 10% for print, 30% for digital. So at the same time, you're seeing this squeeze on mainstream media. Do you see this all as related?
I think it's related in complicated ways. I mean, I think that, you know, part of the challenge of the Post is that in its most important market, the United States, people were obsessively following politics when Donald Trump was president and are not following it as obsessively, which is, by the way, probably healthy. I mean, I don't want to sort of, not all obsessive news consumption, it may be good for the news industry, it doesn't always reflect well on society either.
Right. Well, I mean, it's not healthy when you lose 250 people at a news organization, right?
No, that's awful.
But you know, as we're seeing this news play out and people getting their news from social media, from places like Semaphore that are not traditional news organizations, do you see this as reshaping the news environment in the long term?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that right now the challenge, both whether you are KCRW or the New York Times or Semaphore or some guy on Substack, is to find a way to both take your original journalism and then the chaos of social media and of other voices that maybe people used to want to go wait out there on their own, but now is so confusing. You're so likely to see something horrific that you don't know if it's real or false in a conflict like this, that I think the challenge is to find a way to present both your own reporting and other sources in a way that's filtered and trusted and contextualized to your audience.
Yeah. So moderated, in other words, or content moderation.
Yeah, but I think maybe they do, the notion that some random executive at Twitter or Facebook is the, you know, the capital C, capital M content moderator is going to be replaced by, well, I trust this host on KCRW, I trust Semaphore, I trust the New York Times, if they are willing to link to other sources to do that work for me. And I think that's, you know, the challenge and opportunity for news organizations in this moment.
Ben Smith, editor-in-chief at Semaphore, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, how an arrest and new testimony may finally solve the Tupac Shakur murder case. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A couple of weeks ago, on a quiet residential street in suburban Las Vegas, police arrested a 60-year-old man named Dwayne Davis. And while Davis sat in the back seat of the squad car, he made some small talk with one of the officers.
So what they got you for, man?
Biggest case in Las Vegas history.
Oh, yeah? Like recent?
September 7th.
1996. Oh, no. Wow.
So it's a little hard to hear there, but Davis is saying he's in there for the biggest case in Las Vegas history on September 7th, 1996. And that surprise from the officer arresting him is also a moment of recognition, because Davis is talking about the murder of hip-hop legend Tupac Shakur. Davis is now under indictment for first-degree murder. It's the first time charges have ever been brought in the killing that happened nearly three decades ago. Joe Coscarelli joins me now. He's a music and culture writer for the New York Times and author of the book Rap Capital and Atlanta Story. He and his colleagues pored over hundreds of pages of grand jury testimony in this case to reconstruct what led up to that night and how it changed hip-hop. Welcome back to Press Play, Joe.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so let's go back to that night in Las Vegas, September 7th, 1996. Tupac and Suge Knight, who was the head of Death Row Records, were cruising the Las Vegas Strip. Tupac in the passenger seat, and he had been leaning out of the window talking to some women in a car next to him at a stoplight. That car drives up off. And another car pulls up. It's a white Cadillac with Davis in it and three other guys. They had been looking for Tupac. And here is Davis describing that moment in a 2018 interview with BET.
He wouldn't even been out the window. We would have never seen him. When he pulled up, I was in the front seat. Happened to see my friend, Chubb.
Chubb looks over, he sees you.
Yeah.
He looks right at you.
He says, yeah, he looked right at me. What happened next?
I mean, shots were fired from the Cadillac towards Suge Knight's BMW, hitting both Tupac and grazing Suge Knight in the head and eventually taking Tupac's life.
Yeah. So he died a week later. He was just 25 years old. Why were they looking for him?
So this is a story that goes back hours and then days and then weeks and then years. And it really involves two local Southern California gang factions from Compton, the Southside Crips and the Mob Piru Bloods. And Tupac and Suge Knight with Death Row had become closely aligned with the Bloods, whereas the Southside Crips, their sworn enemies, had a bit of a alliance with the East Coast label Bad Boy. What started as a rap rivalry between Tupac and his one-time friend, Notorious B.I.G., they have their own little beef going, and that's mostly musical. But when it combines with this sort of long-festering gang beef from Compton, that's when it explodes this night in Las Vegas in 1996.
And also, there had been a brawl at a mall.
Yes.
Right before, a few weeks before, they all ended up in Las Vegas. And they were in Las Vegas to watch a Mike Tyson fight, a boxing match, right?
Correct, yes. And the fight lasted less than 2 minutes. So already this night is topsy-turvy because Tyson does this insane knockout in the first round. And that sort of sets off this chain of events that goes all the way back to this mall brawl that you're referring to.
Right. Well, first, before we get to the brawl, why was it that the fight lasting so short, why did that set off a chain of events?
I think everyone's night just didn't go exactly as planned. Uh-huh. Tupac is supposed to be performing later that evening at the new Death Row Club, Club 662, which on a telephone pad stands for Mob. So he's supposed to be there for the after party. Some people in Tupac's crew, as we know from this grand jury testimony that was recently released, didn't even make it to their seats in time before Mike Tyson ends the fight. So I think, you know, people are just trying to figure out what their next move is, and everything is thrown into question because of the accelerated schedule of the evening.
Okay, so let's go back a few weeks previously to the Lakewood Mall brawl. Why is that an inciting incident, and what happened?
So we already know that the Bloods and the Crips, especially in Southern California, in Compton, are sworn rivals. It's basically on site when they see one another out. Now, we learn from the grand jury testimony of Devonta Lee, who was an affiliate of the Compton Southside Crips at this time. He said that Mr. Davis, better known as Keefe D, the local sort of general of the Crips who was arrested last week, he had sent a football player to the mall to go back to school shopping. Star football player, getting ready to go to college. He's affiliated with the Crips, so they're going to protect him at the mall, and they're going to go on a little shopping spree before he goes off to school to represent them on a more national level. Now, they're walking through the mall, and they see a group of Bloods. And one of these Bloods is wearing a Death Row chain. He's also a football player, and he has his own alliances on the other side. Now, immediately, they start bickering. They start throwing up their sets to one another. And before you know it, there's a brawl that ruins the Foot Locker in the Lakewood Mall. And the chain, the Death Row chain, which is described in this grand jury testimony as like someone's crown. It's a trophy. It's a jewel to be protected. And the Crips steal it from the neck of a Blood affiliate.
But I guess I'm wondering, like, what is the link between this brawl in Lakewood, the stealing of the chain, and then this group of guys hunting down Tupac or looking for him that night on the Las Vegas Strip?
So that's another fight that happens in between. So when Tupac and Suge are at the fight, they're leaving the hotel at the MGM Grand, the arena there, and they happen to upon a man named Orlando Anderson. He's the nephew of Keefe D, the nephew of Dwayne Davis, who was arrested in the killing. And he takes a moment to go to the bathroom on his own without his friends. And Tupac and Suge and their group of Bloods spots Orlando, and they're with the chain-snatching victim from the mall. And he says, that guy right there was part of the group that took my chain. And immediately, Tupac and his friends, and this is caught on security camera, this is known at the time, even almost three decades ago, they jump on Orlando Anderson and they start to punch and kick him. And that's retaliation for what happened at the mall.
So Orlando Anderson is in the car, in the Cadillac, that pulls up alongside Tupac Shakur and Suge Knight. And for many years, it was thought he pulled the trigger. Do we know if that's true?
We don't know exactly who pulled the trigger. For many years, it was assumed that it had been Orlando Anderson and that he was, in fact, retaliating for being beaten up in the MGM Grand after the Tyson fight. So after he gets jumped by Death Row, he goes back to Keefe D, his uncle, you know, the big time Crip who's with them, and says, Tupac and Suge, they got me. And so they spend the rest of the night trying to track those guys down to get their own revenge. So it's this endless cycle of little fights where these guys see each other in public, they get one over, and then it's that person's turn to respond. So Orlando, his uncle, and two others get into this Cadillac, and they at first they think they're going to find Suge and Tupac at the club where the after party is supposed to be. They do a little bit of a stakeout there in the parking lot, and they're basically giving up and going home. Keefe D writes in his memoir, which came out in 2019, that they were just going to stop by the liquor store and go party and figure out their revenge another night. But as they're rolling down towards the strip, that's when they spot Tupac and Suge in the BMW, and they take their chance right then and there.
But had they intended, and I guess maybe this will come out in trial or not, to actually kill Tupac or just to scare him?
You know, I think they went there with the intention of doing serious harm to both Suge Knight and Tupac. This was, as we said, a long simmering rivalry. And the beatdown that they give to Orlando Anderson only hours later, that we learn from this grand jury testimony and from many years of these affiliates talking about what happened that night, that was a huge sign of disrespect. And Orlando Anderson was, because of his relationship with Keefe D, with Dwayne Davis, his uncle, he was a member to be protected. He had a high ranking. They talk about him having a sort of silver spoon of gang affiliation because of his family connections. So for Tupac and Suge and their friends to beat this guy up, that demanded a very serious response. Now, the thought is that because Orlando Anderson was the one who got beat up, that he should be the one to pull the trigger in revenge. But because of the arrangement of the car, with Keefe D sitting in the passenger seat, his nephew sitting behind him, and Tupac on the other side, now we learn from this grand jury testimony that, in fact, it may have been the other man in the back seat with Orlando Anderson to his left who fired out of the window and eventually hit and killed Tupac.
So all three are dead now. The guy that you just mentioned, DeAndre Smith, he died in 2004 for health reasons. The other two, including Orlando Anderson, the nephew, killed in gang-related shootings. And so Dwayne Davis is the only one who's still alive, who's in that car, and he is now under indictment. So what happens now, do you think?
So Dwayne Davis being arrested, I think, is one of the more shocking developments in recent hip-hop history. This is a case that, even though the broad outlines of this beef that we've been describing were known, and even the events of that night, Orlando Anderson being beaten up, we've seen that security footage for decades now. Yet Dwayne Davis was out here talking about being the only living person left in that white Cadillac. And he seemed to do so without facing any consequences. So I think that emboldened him. And as a gangster getting up there in age, you know, he calls himself a five-star general. He's very proud of the things that he accomplished in his underworld lifestyle and career. You know, he was known as a big drug trafficker. He called the shots in his neighborhood. And I think as he's speaking more and more about this over the years, people are starting to wonder, like, you know, if this guy's saying how this all went down, why have we not seen charges in this case? So I think the Las Vegas police jumping on this now is meant to bring closure, really, to what has long persisted as one of, you know, the most jarring pop culture deaths of the 20th century. And I think getting Davis on it, using his own words against him, the many interviews he's given over the last few years, I think that is meant to be a sense of closure, not only for Tupac Shakur and his family, but also the fans who have followed the ins and outs of this case, which, you know, really, really disrupted the path of hip hop through popular culture.
Joe, thank you so much for bringing us up to date on this incredible story.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. That's Joe Coscarelli, music and culture writer for the New York Times and author of the book Rap Capital, an Atlanta Story. The story of a black family in the South who refuses to give up their land. Two members of that family are sent to jail for years.
They are put in jail without knowing for how long. So imagine what this does to you when you did not commit a crime.
Raoul Peck, who directed the Oscar-nominated film I Am Not Your Negro, is back with a new documentary. It's called Silver Dollar Road. A conversation with him next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. A big reason for the wealth gap between white and black Americans is property ownership. For a brief period after the Civil War, black farmers were allowed to buy property. You remember, 40 acres and a mule. But during Jim Crow, many of them were forced off their land by white terrorists or by dubious legal means. It's estimated that since the early 20th century, black people have lost hundreds of billions of dollars because of lost land. And that story continues today. A new documentary called Silver Dollar Road explores what happened to a North Carolina family that owned waterfront property.
My daddy, the day before he died, he told me, he said, Gertrude, I won't be with y'all long. He said, and whatever you do, don't let the white man have my land.
That's Gertrude Reels. Two members of her family spent 8 years in prison rather than give up their homes. Raoul Peck directed this documentary, which is based on a ProPublica investigation. Peck's film, I Am Not Your Negro, was nominated for an Academy Award in 2016. Welcome back to Press Play.
Hey, how are you?
Hi, nice to have you back on the show. Your movie is based on a story by ProPublica, which documented the history of the Reels family. Elijah Reels, who was born into slavery, bought this land back in 1911, and it's surrounding Silver Dollar Road, which leads through the wilderness to the waterfront. So describe the land that he bought and what he did with it.
Well, it's basically 75 acres of land. Most of it swamp on the coast, because that's pretty much the type of land that black former enslaved could buy. Because, you know, as you stated in your introduction, you know, the 40 acres never came and the mule neither. So the only type of land they could afford were really lands that nobody wanted. But like most black farmers, they managed to do something with those land, and they became very productive land.
So Elijah buys this land, this swamp land that wasn't worth much, but he turns it into something. He farms it and has children and passes his land on, and he passes it on to his son, Mitchell. Mitchell dies in 1970, and this is where the problems begin for the Reels family, because Mitchell died without a will telling exactly what should happen to the land. And so what happened after he died? How was this land thrown into confusion as to who actually owned it?
Well, without going in all the details, because it's a complicated legal case, but one other sibling called Shedrick came with a sort of fraudulent deed to reclaim part of that land, and the part that is underwater, which is the most precious part, because you can fish, you can use it for many things. That brings money. So while the rest of the family and the grandmother, Gertrude Reels, have registered correctly that they actually own 75 acres. But when Shedrick launched the procedure, they were not correctly represented. And it was like there was two parallel legal procedure, and they did not communicate with each other. So when the judges basically gave that portion of 13 acres to Shedrick Wills, they disregard the fact that the grandmother had already cleared up the titles. So it's the misunderstanding starts right there. And what the family didn't know is that they only had 1 year to claim the land back.
Yeah. So Shedrick claimed that he had ownership to this waterfront property, the 13 acres, and he didn't really legally own that property?
No, and the proof he brought to the judge were inconsistent with the reality.
Mm. So then he sells it to a development company, right? And this development company wants to do what with the land?
Probably invest and developed it, you know, built houses, built additional, how do you call that, boats, landing.
Like a marina?
Marina, uh-huh. Exactly. And, you know, you have to see, when you see the whole region from the air, you see that everything has been developed. There are multiple multi-million dollar villas. So it's a very valuable piece of property.
What your film portrays is this very poignant past of the Reels family and this particular beach. It was a place where they could feel free because there were other beaches in the area that didn't want Black people there. But this was a beach for Black people. And the family has these really beautiful memories.
It was just the one place you could go and you wasn't worried about being targeted by the law, and you didn't have to feel like you were being harassed. You could just relax.
Can you talk a little bit about that side of the story?
Well, it was important that the film begins with that, to see that family basically happy with what they had. They didn't really need anybody. They were living from the land. They were farming. And part of the family was, fishing, shrimping, and they were okay with that. And once they start, losing that land, it became, a huge problem for them. You know, the land was everything they had. That was their identity, and also for the whole community around. You know, Mermont and Cattaray County. It was important for us to show, you know, the role of that place, of Silver Dollar Road, for the white Black community. And don't forget that they didn't have access to any of the beaches. And they felt, you know, Silver Dollar Road was the only place, like Mamie in the film said, where they didn't feel targeted by the law, you know?
Yeah. Right. So Mamie Reels Ellison is Mitchell Reels's granddaughter. She's the new matriarch of this family. And here she is talking about the importance of Silver Dollar Road.
So if you clear out Silver Dollar Road, where are you going? And not that we want to go anywhere, because this is ours, our ancestors.
So she and her entire family have lived there their whole lives. And your film also focuses on her two brothers, Melvin and Ly Curtis, who went to prison for refusing to leave the land. Why were they sent to prison?
Again, it's a long procedure, but at the end, don't forget, the whole thing, took like several decades. You know, it started, as you say, in 1970. And now we are around 2007, 2008, there have been many attempts to get the two brothers out of the property. And the two brothers didn't see why. They were born on the property. So they decided to, despite the court order, they decided not to vacate. They had their houses on the property. They had a judgment where basically the judge decided to condemn them for contempt, which is normally a case where you can spend a month or two, maximum 90 days. And after 90 days, you usually come back in front of the judge. In that case, the judge decides something that is totally unheard of, is he put them in jail without limit until they sign a paper saying they're going to vacate the land and destroy their houses. And of course, the two brothers, you know, they say, no way. So that could, you know, go on and on for years. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. And they really suffer. Like Curtis, I believe, develops diabetes, and they both suffer mentally. I think their niece talks about how for a long time after they were released, you know, they weren't back to normal.
Well, of course, until today, it's you know, you have to understand what it means. People who have, you know, lived all their life basically outdoors. Those are people who are on the water all the time or in the forest around their place. They travel in the whole county to work, and they are put in jail without knowing for how long. It's not like you have been condemned for, you know, I don't know, 1 year, 2 years, 5 years. So imagine what this does to you when you did not commit a crime and you profoundly believe that you are in your right, which they were. And you are thrown in a jail. You can hardly do anything in that jail. You are always in that same room. And you don't even know when it's going to end. You know, that's the most profound traumatic experience you can have.
And so they are released. And did they agree to sell, or how did they get released?
Well, after they went through an incredible number of lawyers who, for the most part, took advantage of the family, they finally find a lawyer that came from another county. He could resist the power structure, the local power structure.
Mm.
And he find a way to, you know, defend in front of the judge the absurdity of what he was asking. And that there was other way to solve the problem. Like, you know, the owner could have said, okay, I'm going to destroy the houses and build the two brothers, which they didn't do. Because in the background, there is also, the lawyer did not say it, but I would say the racist part of the whole issue. You know, they wanted to teach those two men a lesson.
So what does it look like now? It's in the footage, it seems that the waterfront, well, it's not developed. The homes of Melvin and Lee Curtis are deteriorating or have deteriorated, fallen apart, and because of storms and neglect, and that they weren't living in them. So what is the status of the land now, and where does the family go from here?
Well, first of all, for the family, the most urgent part is to secure the rest of the property, you know, mm-hmm. And that's, you know, something that we are also helping them do. They are in contact now with organizations who are, you know, invested in changing the rules of this situation. So that's what they are concerned with right now. The 13 acre on the water, so far I know, have been sold again to another entity. We don't know actually what they can do with it, because in order to build whatever you want to build on that property, you still have to cross a whole black neighborhoods of people from the family. You know, it's a one road street. So we are not sure what's going to happen for now. We hope, or I hope personally, that down the line that there will be some sort of agreement with whoever is the new owner, because, you know, I think he's losing money as well, short and middle term. So, but once the family can secure the rest of the property, I think they will be in a stronger position to fight for the rest.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today and shining a light on this story.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Raoul Peck, director of the new documentary Silver Dollar Road, which opens this Friday in theaters, and you can see it on Amazon Prime beginning October 20th.
This is our beach. Uh-huh. This is our land. Right? Mm-hmm. This is our water, our club, everything. Mm-hmm. This is our land.
Okay.
This is our
Yay.
This is our club, our space, anything.
Coming up, you now have the right to, get this, repair your own phone. A new California law explained next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you have the time or the patience, you could take apart your broken vacuum cleaner or toaster to try to fix it. But for your computer or your cell phone, that can just be impossible, not only because they're so complicated, but because they often have locks installed. So you have to take your phone to, say, the Apple Store or buy a new one. Well, now you can get out your mini Allen wrench. As of yesterday, California has a new right to repair law. Minnesota, New York, and Colorado have enacted similar laws too, but California is notable because big tech is based right here. We're going to talk about this now with Sandra Goldmark, professor at Barnard College in New York and author of the book Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thank you.
Okay, so this seems like, why would we need a law to let us repair our own stuff? So why do we need a law to let us repair our own stuff?
It does seem counterintuitive, doesn't it? Many people don't think that the right to repair is a right that needs legislation or protection. But it is, unfortunately, because we've come to a place in this country, or we had come to a place where, largely speaking, many manufacturers, especially of electronics, were making it very hard for individuals or independent repair shops to actually fix their products.
Hmm. So mainly, are we talking about phones?
A lot of the headlines about this right to repair legislation is about phones, because, of course, phones are such a big part of our lives. But it really, the movement really, and the legislation really applies to more than just phones. It actually started with heavy farm equipment. And the current bill that was just signed in California extends to other kinds of home appliances and electronics as well.
Okay, so what does this mean? What do manufacturers have to change?
The basic heart of the legislation is that manufacturers have to provide parts, manuals, and instructions for and software for 7 years after the production and sale of a device above $100, for 3 years for less than $100. So in plain language, that means they have to make it possible for their product to be fixed, and not just by the manufacturer. So they have to make the parts available and the instructions available.
How major is this in your mind? How big a deal is this?
It's funny, because again, when I say that, I feel like it doesn't sound like that big a deal. Okay, they have to make the parts available. Were they not before?
You're right.
And this is why, for me, it's a big deal. The answer is no. Let's look at the kind of poster child for some of this legislation, an iPhone. Historically, if your iPhone broke, you could maybe bring it to a Genius Bar, but a lot of ways that the phone was designed made it very difficult either to repair yourself or for an independent repair shop to fix it. So if you couldn't get Apple to fix it, you were often out of luck and forced to buy a new phone. That is called planned obsolescence. And it has been very, very frustrating for users, for people, because it kind of flies in the face of common sense. This is a perfectly good object. It's got this one little thing broken. Why can't I fix it? So to me, the legislation is a big deal because it's naming something in our society and trying to correct it that is much bigger than a phone. And it has to do with this idea of all of the objects and the stuff that we make, the toll that it takes on the environment to make things that are single use or have a short lifespan, and the frustration and kind of anti-common senseness for individuals who say, wait a minute, I like my phone or my vacuum and I want to keep it. And so it is really exciting and a big deal nationwide, not just in California, to see people saying, hey, wait a minute, this is something that we, no pun intended, we can fix.
Okay, so Apple had initially opposed this, but then decided to embrace the legislation, or at least not oppose it. Do you know why they changed their minds?
I think, now I'm not, you know, I'm inside the corporate boardroom at Apple, but I think it's a really exciting and important sign of a shift in Apple and other companies' understanding of sustainability and what it really means to make climate goals and to make sustainability goals. It used to be a little bit more in the language of, you know, we're going to switch to renewable energy and put solar panels on the roof, or maybe reduce waste in packaging. But if your core business model is making and selling and extracting resources for more and more and more phones every year, it really doesn't matter how many solar panels or how much reduced packaging you do. So companies today, I think, are realizing they have to look at their core product. And that means designing things to have a long lifespan, designing things that can be fixed, designing things that are made responsibly in the first place. And so it's exciting. This is part of really looking at that core business model and getting serious about it.
Forgive me for being a little bit cynical, but I'm really wondering if there's a bottom line reason why they also decided to embrace this, because I would imagine that they wouldn't want to give up all those profits, those extra phones that they could sell without having a B plan in place.
I love that you said that, because I actually think I want Apple to make repair part of their business plan. I want them to make selling used phones a core part of their business model. I want to free the big corporations from the prison of always selling and making ever cheaper new stuff. So now I don't want them to take over all of the repair revenue. I want independent repairers and individuals to be able to repair their objects. But actually, I think in the long run, if we can make repair and reuse as much a part of our economy as the sale of new goods, I think that's a good thing and it's something that should happen.
Yeah. I don't know if you can answer this, but just anecdotally, I've noticed that when there are new versions of the operating system up and you have to, you know, renew that, it changes the phone, not necessarily in a good way. It makes it a little more kludgy, making you more prone to buy a new one if you have an old phone. Would this change that, or is that a separate issue altogether?
I think, sadly, I'm not totally sure because I'm not an expert on all the ins and outs of the bill, but I think it's unfortunately a separate issue. There have been a lot of studies about that very thing, and there has been evidence showing that, yes, you are not imagining things.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Sometimes you feel a little crazy when you look at your phone and you're like, really? Is it just me? Did I not have a
phone? I don't know. I feel like my phone is gaslighting me.
Right. I don't think it is. But I think that's a little bit the next step down the road of really, if we're really going to begin designing for longevity, that can no longer be part of the equation. But the right to repair bill is really more focusing on the parts and the manual. So it's a good first step there.
Yeah. And so do you think that people will actually want to then get out their tools and repair their phones or whatever products? Or will they be so used to saying, oh, forget it, I can't do this, I'll just buy a new one?
I think it both will happen. And I think there's a middle option, which I'm really excited about, which this bill and legislation like this makes it easier for independent repair shop owners to provide that service. So I ran short-term repair shops all over New York City for 7 years, from 2013 to 2020. And we fixed all kinds of stuff. Phones, we actually stopped fixing phones because they made us insane. But like vacuums, lamps, appliances, all kinds of products that are affected by this bill. And we were able to fix 85% of the stuff we got. And great. Of what we called our repair fails, 70% of those fails were because either of we couldn't get the parts or we couldn't get the manual.
All right, we'll have to end it there. Sandra Goldmark, professor at Barnard College and author of the book Fixation, How to Have Stuff Without Breaking the Planet. I'm Madeline Brand. That's it for the show. I'll see you tomorrow.